my current strong opinion loosely held about why we create and specifically why we create art, it's because we are trying to share the essence of our subjective experience with others. Because there is no language for that, the language of experience is one that we haven't codified yet. We've tried to find all these different ways. So it is that impossible task of trying to share what it is to feel and be human.
Hey there. Welcome to Lessons in Creativity, where we'll explore the creative process across different disciplines and learn how to harness this natural part of our human experience. I'm Jenna Massey, your fellow student and host. In this episode, I spoke with Scott Wolfson. Scott's career has ranged all the way from being a street performer, video producer, radio broadcaster, to working at KPMG and BCG in innovation consulting. Today, Scott self-identifies as a curious human and is on a personal mission to help people love to learn, changing their minds. In this episode, you'll hear Scott talk about his views on creativity, identity, how he approaches learning in this age of AI, and his newest cohort-based bootcamp, Workcrafting, which he co-created with his business partner, Kez Sampanther, to help individuals embrace uncertainty and craft a career. There is so much in this episode, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Welcome, Scott, to the podcast. Thanks so much for being here today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Jenna. I am so grateful for this opportunity to have this conversation with you.
Awesome. Let's dive in. All right. Well, I love to start with this question about childhood and thinking back to age 6, 7, 8, and thinking about the ways in which your creativity came out. But for you, I want to add an extra question on there, because for those who don't know Scott, he is extremely unapologetically himself. He's extremely unique. He's in front of me wearing a bright shirt, as always, describes himself on LinkedIn as a curious human. So I'm curious for you, Scott, has that part of you always been there, or was there an evolution to getting to that point?
It is a truly beautiful question. And Jenna, you know how much of a fan of questions I am. I've done a lot of both introspection and retrospection, especially over the past few years. And I don't think I'm special or unique in that respect. I think that is something that living through these truly unprecedented times, especially with COVID, you know, facing a true existential threat, unlike, you know, maybe AI, that it gave one of the ways that I have reframed living through a global pandemic, because it sucked, was that it afforded us the opportunity to really think about what it is that truly matters to us. And for me, a lot of that thinking is based on going back, right? And as I've thought back about my childhood, and to your point about my somewhat atypical LinkedIn profile identification, I do identify first and foremost as a curious human. And as I thought back over my life, and especially as a child, that my curiosity truly has been one of my biggest superpowers. It has been one of my biggest motivating drivers in my life. And especially when I think about that age range from, you know, 6, 7, and 8, I grew up moving around a little bit. My dad was in the Coast Guard. So when I was 2.5, we moved from Northern Virginia to San Diego, California. And from 3 to 10, I grew up in San Diego. And this was, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s. And it was, in hindsight, just a fascinating time to be growing up. Look, as a somewhat jaded, at times cynical slacker, and I'd say potentially jaded and cynical a lot more in my teenage years and maybe my 20s, I thought back about my childhood through a fairly cynical lens, a very ironic lens, I guess, was one of the defining characteristics, especially of slackers and Gen X. But in retrospect, it was an amazing time for me culturally. Look, when I was, I think, 7 and 8 years old, I was taking breakdancing lessons. You know, I was a little, I absolutely did. I don't remember how I stumbled upon it. other than my insatiable curiosity and my love of music. That's certainly something I got from my father, music and storytelling. And, you know, my dad would read to my brother and I every night before we went to bed. He read through the entire Wizard of Oz series. He read through all the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, all of these fantasy books that in hindsight, I think did incept this insatiable curiosity. And we were lucky that, you know, I didn't grow up wealthy at all, but we were lucky enough to be able to afford to do fun things and indulge our curiosity, both me and my brother, who's 2.5 years younger than me. And for me at that time, 6, 7, and 8, I was taking breakdancing lessons. I've always been fascinated with weird stuff, with unusual things, with things that just don't make sense. And so I am somebody that is great to have on your trivia team. But
I could see that.
at that age, especially some of those really formative years, as I've thought back about it, I was absolutely insatiably, and if you ask my parents, I'm sure they would probably say frustratingly curious, you know, going beyond just the cliche 3-year-old asking why, which now I understand intellectually is at the heart of the Toyota production system and the 5 whys, which can really help you continuously improve every aspect of your life and work. And at the time, fortunately, my parents would indulge me, or sometimes they go, you know, go figure it out. And I'd try to.
I can definitely see 6 or 7-year-old Scott breakdancing. Not surprised on that one. Your career path really has taken on a ton of creativity. And you've done everything from photography, video production, corporate innovation. And in many ways, you've taken on like many different identities. And I think a big part of you being able to do this is like this constant reinvention of yourself and detachment to certain identities. So I'm curious how you think about identities in the context of your career progression.
I think a lot about identity that certainly won't surprise you. And it's a lot easier to say now as I'm a few months away from hitting the half century mark, which is really insane to me. I laugh when I think about the number of my age because I feel like I'm somehow getting over. Like I shouldn't be allowed to be 49 years old. And I've gotten over that sense of needing permission to continue to have a childlike sense of curiosity and wonder in the world. And so I can say confidently at this point that I am striving to embrace identity as an emergent property. It is a more of a state than a trait, and something that is constantly changing. And as I've thought about my entire life, I have always, in hindsight, lived, as Brené Brown might say, wholeheartedly. I have been on this constant quest to understand and discover who I am at my core. So I can really figure out what am I all about? What am I doing here? And what can I offer to the world around me? And so that sense of identity in hindsight and in retrospect has always been as fluid as it always will be. And I think getting to the point of embracing that sense of our identities are very, very fluid. There are some potentially anchoring or constant aspects, and those get into the sense of, you know, what is my why? You know, what do I truly, truly value? What are the first principles of my value and belief system? And then, you know, through that lens, when I look back over my professional history, well, I can confidently say, it's a lot easier to say it from this point, looking back, that look, a big part of what has helped me be as successful as I guess I am has been to try to live as wholeheartedly as possible to understand, well, to and follow that curiosity. And the an authentic sense of curiosity, deep curiosity. At this point, I'll go ahead and start dropping the book references. read this amazing book called Seek by Scott Shigeoka. And he's got this wonderful framework around what he calls deep curiosity. When you have a sense of deep curiosity, as Scott writes about in Seek, it's a lot easier to prioritize what it is that you follow. So, you know, if you think about, like, I know we're both big fans of essentialism, and as well as like a Cal Newport and deep work, and the clarity that comes with a true sense of what you really, really care about in the world, what truly motivates you. That's one of the things that has, you know, on a meta level, has ended up motivating me to learn more about motivation, is that learning in and of itself can create a virtuous flywheel. And the more that you learn, the more that you want to learn, because you learn that you don't know anything. And recognizing that you're playing that infinite game then opens up an incredible world of possibilities. So look, that is all well and good and very theoretical. But when I look back over my professional life, which I often jokingly refer to as, you know, being a good old Gen X hipster, of course I did something before it had a name. And if you look at my LinkedIn profile, it is a portfolio career. I've made these non-linear jumps. I have, you know, discontinuously innovated myself, to your point. And those jumps have come from both a deep sense of curiosity and some clarity in terms of my sense of identity. So that has been a consistent thread. When I went into TV news at my first TV station, Charlie Paparella, who now has, fortunately, his own series on WBOC, Travels with Charlie, you know, and he told me about how much he had learned from one of his mentors, this master storyteller, Scorchy Taws, on the eastern shore of the Delmarva Peninsula in Salisbury, Maryland. I was surrounded by master visual storytellers, wow, these other photogs, Doug and Carlos Hernandez, the chief photographer, who had been a Vietnam War film newsman. Like, it was amazing. And again, in hindsight, I can recognize how lucky I got, but it wasn't dumb luck. It was intentional, because I was super curious. I wanted to learn. I wanted to get better. I realized how much I loved telling stories, and I very intentionally went into TV news with the beginner's mind. And I didn't have to pretend at that point. I had a beginner's mind. I didn't know anything. And I started from those first principles. And that is something that I now realize, you know, I am making that conscious now, and that is how I approach my life now. So it's a lot easier to connect those dots in hindsight, much like Steve Jobs said.
It's really amazing that your view of identity is crucial to this. You are not attached to yourself as an identity, and you're able to walk away from it, which I think you and I have both seen in working in corporate innovation can be very, very challenging. And I think for anyone who's going through a career shift or attempting to take on this type of portfolio career is a lot easier said than done. It takes a big mindset shift. I think you're also really interesting, your curiosity and your love of learning and your interest in learning, in seeking out mentors and noticing your process of learning is so critical to your ability to continuously transform yourself in all these new fields.
Well, you know, one of my literal shower thoughts this morning was the realization, and I love words for so many reasons. And one of the words that I've been really, really fixated with understanding amusingly enough, is the word understanding. And part of what I realized about that word, and at the risk of sounding reductionist and creating a false dichotomy, you know, there's only two kinds of people in the world. Understanding is one that's very interesting to me because from what I have seen, there are two very disparate reactions when it comes to understanding, and more specifically, not understanding. And what I have come to realize is that when I don't understand something, that is like crack to me. I gotta know. Like, wait, what am I missing? What do I not understand? This is fascinating. That is the lens that I take on the world. And there is the other reaction or the other response to not understanding. And it's one that, you know, it frustrates me at times, but I understand it because I feel it too. I won't say that I only feel good and excited and more curious when I don't understand things. It can be frustrating. But when I see people get frustrated, and even worse, when I see people get angry, that is when it does make me sad. I do feel compassion for folks who get angry when they don't understand things. And the shower thought that hit me this morning is that one of the biggest challenges of truly practicing and embracing and living a curious life is to learn to love not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And once you start, because I feel like I am just starting to get over that hump because it's uncomfortable AF all the time. But with the right mindset, like a Carol Dweck would say, if you can make that flip, man, the world gets so much more exciting. And so to your point, that and that sense of not knowing, even to the point of identity and going, you know what? I don't know more about who I truly am than I do know. And if I accept that that will always be true, well, you know what? That turns into another, the best infinite game I can imagine, which is that I get to spend the rest of my life trying to really figure out who I am. That is going to be infinitely rewarding. So then it makes it a lot easier to do the challenging thing. To your point, especially working in innovation as a knowledge worker, as somebody who creates things for a living, if that is too much a part of your identity, if the things that you create define you, like, look, I can now look back and I've created a lot over the course of my life. I've created, you know, the street performing acts that I did in Amsterdam. I created literally hundreds, probably thousands of news stories between what I did with the FEMA radio network and then in 11 and a half years in TV news. And then as I have forked out of TV news to working at a digital experience agency and doing marketing and marketing videos and public relations, and then working with industry analysts at Forrester and Gartner and IDC, and then helping to start the innovation labs at KPMG, and then evolving into a professional design thinker and innovator, I've created this, you know, this intellectual property as it's formally known. I've helped to create thought leadership. If you still have an attachment or a strong connection between your ideas and your sense of identity, but as you can let go of that, as I've learned, then it's a lot easier to embrace. Like, one of my mental models has been the Tibetan sand mandala mindset. And if you're not familiar, this was when I was in Salisbury, Maryland, I had the amazing opportunity to cover. There was a group of Tibetan Buddhist monks that were visiting Salisbury University. And one of the things that they did while they were visiting, they taught a lot. They went bowling, and my friend Danny took them bowling, and I didn't get to go. And it really bummed me out because that would have been amazing. But I did get to shoot a story with the monks as they were creating one of their famous sand mandalas. And these sand mandalas, I implore people to Google this if you've never seen one, are these beautiful, intricate, and they are incredibly vividly colorful. What the monks do is they meticulously, laboriously, they hunch over with these little cones, that these brass cones that are filled with brightly colored sand. And they have these little rods, and it scrapes against the cones. And that releases grains of sand, grains of colored sand, one at a time. And they spend hours and hours and hours of the course of days creating this intricate, vivid, colorful, beautiful mandala. And when they're done, they scoop it all up. And they take that colored sand, and then they dump it into a flowing body of river. And doing that with things that you have created, that you have put out in the world, is one of the hardest things to do. But when you can, and when you realize that is a true freedom, that frees you up to create something better. Don't tie yourself to what you've done in the past, because it can always be better.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That is a powerful image. Yeah. And it's funny when you said, if you recognize that you don't know what your identity is, you have the rest of your life to find it, to experiment, to figure it out. There's a freedom in that, right? You're not tied down to one thing. You're not attached to one thing. That's really interesting. And just making sure that you're constantly reminding yourself and pulling yourself back to that curious state, to detachment, to identity. Part of my reason in starting this podcast is also to dive deeper into how people are balancing the creative and the practical, and in corporate innovation, the need to diverge and go wide and go into unknowns without any expectation of what could come of it, but then also the necessity to converge and to put something out there in business that is going to make money. And I think that paradox can be hard. You've worked a ton on this, and it sounds like you have the ability to hold those two concepts within yourself.
Where I've gotten to is, I think, perhaps best embodied in this new phrase that Kez came up with related to work crafting, that really it resonated so strongly. And I'll try to unpack it and explain why it hit me so hard. Probably the number one question in the last decade as an innovation professional, you know, helping lead global digital transformations with design thinking and neuroscience, it is, when do you know to converge? And the point that I've gotten to is, well, it's when you have to. And the phrase that Kez just coined that really struck me, and I think captures it so well, is he said, you have to create your cliff. Now, that's in the case of work crafting. Let me share some other ways that I think about what that means. What does it mean to create your cliff? One of the first phrases that bubbles up for me is that adage of burn the boats. The notion that, like, okay, we're going to sail across the ocean and we are not going to even give ourselves the opportunity of going back to where we once were. We are going to burn the boats. We are going to create our cliff. We are going to create for ourselves, as you know, one of our shared mentors and Sherpas, as I like to call Colleen Drummond, would say, you have to create a forcing function for yourself. So when do you exploit? When do you converge? Yes, it depends. But what I will say is, it doesn't just depend. You do it when you have to. And one of the many profound lessons that I've learned in my time and my partnership, my friendship, my professional working relationship with Kes is that he has a unique superpower to diverge longer, to go deeper and farther into the most complex and esoteric domains of knowledge than any person I have ever met or heard about. And I now am getting to the point where I feel like I'm starting to understand what he means when he says, oh, converge? Well, that's the easy part. The hardest part is to diverge as long as you can. He likens it to holding your breath. And that is an analogy that resonates with me, especially. And you and I have co-facilitated countless design thinking workshops. Yeah. And we've seen how uncomfortable people get. Because when you're diverging, you're not knowing. We know from evolutionary psychology that that is seriously uncomfortable for our brains. But again, if you can make that flip and you can embrace that deep curiosity. I mean, this goes back to like one of the many public experiments I've run in the past couple of years. And it was my month-long personal LinkedIn challenge to write something that I thought was worth reading every day for a month. And I needed a hook for myself to get myself motivated, because that's one of the reasons that, like, one of the easiest ways that I have gotten motivated to do things that nobody else is willing to do and figure out things that I can do that nobody else possibly can is by reading as much about human motivation as I can to understand how it works down to the level of the neuron from neuroscience. Yeah. And so I came up with that idea of maybe May, because I thought it was, one, a funny and clever and hooky and sticky name, and clever. Again, I love wordplay. From their surfaces to their essences, I love words. And it was a concept that I knew I could spend not just an entire month, but the rest of my life unpacking. That cliff that I created for myself, that forcing function to first say, I'm going to write something I think is worth reading every day for a month. And that first day, I really put myself out there, because I said, I'm going to be writing about this and what I call the maybe mindset. Mm-hmm. And publicly, I said, I'm going to figure out over the next month what the maybe mindset means. It is that comfort with being uncomfortable. It is living a paradoxical life. And it is embodied in that famous proverb of the Chinese farmer that I shared on day one of maybe May in 2023, where when faced with good fortune and misfortune, the wise Chinese farmer responds with people saying, what good luck or what bad luck, with a single word, and that is maybe.
Mm. Wow, I love that. I want to segue into talking about the future of work, because you and I have talked about this a little bit, but I think one element of the future of work is working in public. And this is something that you were just talking about and speaking about, in putting yourself out there and putting things that are half-formed thoughts in progress. Your maybe May experiment is a great example. And I think, one, I think it takes a lot internally to be able to put yourself out there and do that. And I really admire that you've been doing that more. And so I wonder if you could speak a little bit about that process, in addition to what other elements you see are aspects of the future of work.
I can't even begin answering that without invoking yet again one of my biggest intellectual and human heroes, and that, of course, is the queen herself, Brené Brown. It is the power of vulnerability. It does look like courage. I get that for some people, when they watch me get on Tectonic on LinkedIn Live on a Friday, or that Work Crafting 101, it was almost like doing an infomercial, but it's something that I can do because, yes, I have, my voice has ended up becoming a voice that I dreamed of when I was a kid. I don't really know what to attribute it to, and I have not taken voice lessons. That's one of the many things on my long, long, long list of things I really want to do, in addition to learning how to beatbox properly. It does require vulnerability, but it requires that confidence in yourself and the recognition. And this is one of the reasons that I've read a number of Brené's books, because you do need that reminder. Here's one of the other things that when I think about the future of work, of course, I look back. What is the history of work? Why do we work? I can't remember the author's name, but there is a book called Work that is a deep history of work. And look, this is one of those things that for a lot of people is uncomfortable. Why do we work in the first place? Over the past few years, asking myself that question and remaining in that uncomfortable space of not knowing and saying confidently, I don't know what the future of work is, but I do have some ideas about it. Now, as I've thought deeply about the kind of work that I do, I recognize that I'm a knowledge worker. If we can agree that you are a knowledge worker, then I think we can agree that the primary tool that you use in knowledge work is your brain. So if we can agree that the primary tool that you use as a knowledge worker is your brain, then we can agree that at its core, you get paid to think for a living. Well, if you're going to pursue the path of mastery, if you want to go from good to great, as Jim Collins would say, that pursuit of true mastery in and of itself becomes another virtuous flywheel that is self-reinforcing. So it's getting on that path. And then I can say things confidently like, oh, if you're doing it, you're doing it right. And so what is doing it in this case, right? What are people paying you for? So if you are a knowledge worker, then your work is dealing with knowledge in some way, shape, or form. Well, the way that our brains deal with knowledge is through three core processes. It's input, process, output, and that's it. Okay, well, let's scale that up to what we do as knowledge workers then. Then as knowledge workers, we input data, information, knowledge. Ultimately, we process that data, that information, that knowledge, and then we are going to output, you know, maybe it's data, maybe it's information, maybe it's knowledge. Maybe we get all the way up to outputting wisdom. But the only way that we can really get there is by going through that cycle. And so when I think about the future of, I'll be more specific, knowledge work, to me, it's the recognition that what people are paying you for, if you are a knowledge worker, is your thinking. So number one, understand how you think, understand how your brain works, spend time. That is a journey that is an infinite game in and of itself. And then number two, and this is where it does come to the future of work and how work crafting plays into this, you've got to share how you think with other people. Now, we are now in a position in 2024 where the methods through which, the channels through which you can showcase how you think to other people have never been more abundant. It's never been more democratized. I love Reid Hoffman's book, The Startup of You. And I'm realizing, no, the future of work, I think, looks a lot more like the platform of you. Because individuals, I believe, now have tools and technology and channels through which they can independently, as a single person, become a platform and not just an entrepreneur. To me, it is 10Xing your thinking as a solopreneur. And how do you get people to pay you to think? By showing them how you think. And that's what we've been doing over the past few months. And we've then done what Kez does, right? He's the method man. He's a framework guy. We've codified our approach to what we believe is the future of work. And we've done that in work crafting.
So what is work crafting? Let's dive into that.
Well, so, and thank you for indulging me and asking about it. But it does embody what both Kes and I believe is the future of work, and especially the future of knowledge work. So I'll start with why, as Simon Sinek would want me to, and why work crafting and why now? Well, I'll take the first question, which is why work crafting? Well, people have talked about job crafting for at least a number of years. We don't believe that the future of work is jobs. Jobs, I do fundamentally believe, this is a strong opinion, loosely held, that the future of work does not look like jobs the way that we know them. And that is because of one of the most disruptive technological revolutions humanity has ever experienced, and that's what we're living through right now. So why work crafting? Because the nature of work is fundamentally changing, and the future of work is not jobs. So why now? Because the time has never been better, and the time has never been more necessary to really, truly rethink what work looks like and how we go about pursuing the work that we do. So the Happiness of Pursuit is another wonderful, wonderful book that I love. And it to me, it does come into play because what the future of work, and I will use a word that I have trained myself to exorcise from my vocabulary because of how much Brené Brown that I've read, I will invoke the word should, that I believe, again, strong opinion loosely held, and those often come out in the form of should statements, that in order for people to figure out what their future of work looks like, they should have a clear understanding of what really drives them to do what they do. What truly motivates you? This goes back to me spending all of this time, you know, navel gazing for, as some people might think about it, and really thinking back to, yeah, who am I? What has really motivated me throughout my life? It's bringing rigor to something that is as squishy as, it's a great framework. All models are wrong, but some are useful. Ikigai is a great framework, but there's no rigor to it. So we've brought rigor to first starting with why. Like, it's great to say, start with why. We have codified a very rigorous approach based on a deep understanding of human motivation to really help people understand, first off, who they are, what is your wow? This notion of, you know, in the world of work crafting, what is your wow? When I explain your wow, that's your superpowers. Those are your unique abilities, your unique capabilities. The things that you know, it is that sense of mastery. The mastery isn't doing something great. It's doing something uniquely great. How do you figure that out? That's what we've codified. And that's where you have to start. And once you find your wow, once you have explored, once you have diverged and really explored your wow, and you've done your own retrospective, and you've talked to other people who know you now, who have known you as different identities throughout your past, then you can really converge and start to clarify, okay, this is my wow. This is the things that this unique combination of the things that I can do that nobody else on the planet can do, and the things that I'm willing to do that nobody else on the planet is willing to do. If you can figure that out, you can then discover your wow. Then you go into the second phase of work crafting. Because before you start putting stuff out there, before you start throwing spaghetti against the wall, look, one of the things that we know about humans that is unique is that we are meaning-seeking creatures. If we can understand and tap into our intrinsic motivation, that is the most powerful flywheel possible. But we have to have clarity of what truly motivates us. Again, the names of these three phases, wow, how, now, it sounds deceptively simple. It is like Jon Kabat-Zinn would say about mindfulness. And then the final phase, which requires what I said earlier, is that notion of creating a cliff, burning the boats, a forcing function. This is where that sense of everybody embracing and adopting an entrepreneurial mindset, and that adage that an entrepreneur is somebody who jumps off a cliff and builds an airplane on the way down. It's not looking at the future of work as what color is my parachute. And so what we've tried to do is take this new approach, create that cliff. And look, sometimes that cliff gets created for you. That is what is capital T true for tens, hundreds of thousands of knowledge workers who probably did not expect to be on the market. From big tech, from big four consulting firms, from McKinsey, Bain, and BCG. There is that flood of talent that is out in the market, the likes of which we have not seen in probably at least 20, 25 years. If you've been laid off, you probably have a finite window where you need to identify, what is my freedom number? And so in phase three, because you're approaching that cliff, so how do you know when to exploit? How do you know when to converge? How do you know when to snap the line? It's when you are approaching that cliff, when you run out of money, when you have burned the boats. And that is the scariest thing in the world. And that's why in phase three, we lovingly refer to it as Leroy Jenkins, an homage to the legendary meme from the World of Warcraft. In phase three, you need to be testing your wow, how you exploit your wow as frequently as possible, and doing so in public, and doing so in ways that expand your luck surface area, doing so in ways that are as far out of your comfort zone as possible. Because again, it goes back to that notion, this is one of the reasons we brought in that amazing Tim Urban graphic, Tim Urban from waitbutwhy.com fame, his black lines and green lines. This is what we mean by forking the future. And we actually added a little bit more rigor to that beautiful drawing from Tim Urban, where in hindsight, you can see all of the paths that you didn't take. There is only one way that you ended up in this present moment, in this present and temporal identity that you now, embody or inhabit. And what's ahead of you is nothing but forks, forking possibilities. And the further out of your comfort zone that you get, what we call the low fluke zone is what you're comfortable with. In phase three, you've got that cliff and you have to be testing again and going as broad as possible with where you're testing your ideas. Again, getting out of that low fluke zone and trying to get as far out of your comfort zone as possible. And look, that's what we've been doing in public over the past couple of months. So we've taken everything that we have lived and everything that we have learned, and we have packaged that up into, yes, a step-by-step, rigorous, research-based, potentially academic-sounding methodology. It is a mindset. It is ultimately a movement around what we believe is the future of work. That's it. It's simple and not easy. But that is the essence of work crafting in a lot of words.
Wow. So I had a couple light bulbs go off while you were talking that I want to share, because it's interesting. And that framework that you laid out is extremely valuable. I remember reading about this in the book Industries of the Future. It described this future of work that we're starting to see unfold, right? And it drew the parallel to Hollywood and to how actors and producers and videographers come together, make a movie, make a TV show, and then go apart. And then a different group comes together for a movie or a project and then goes apart. Artists that really have been living this way of working by putting their art out there, putting their songs out there, seeing who's willing to collaborate or build off of like what they've put out there. And it's, I think what the light bulb that just went off for me is I've been inspired and attracted to the courage and the bravery that they have to put themselves out there. And that same bravery is really what we now as knowledge workers have to do, because we've had the luxury of hiding behind corporations and being able to share our thoughts just within this institution, which has a certain set of norms already established, where in public, we're just out there. There's no hiding. So I think that's interesting.
Well, take a step back, but look, an amazing book like The Act of Creation by Rick Rubin, right? Why do we create in the first place? The Practice by Seth Godin. Why do we create? Well, my current strong opinion, loosely held, about why we create and specifically why we create art, it's because we are trying to share the essence of our subjective experience with others. And because there is no language for that, the language of experience is one that we haven't codified yet. We've tried to find all these different ways. So some people paint what they see in their dreams, and some people write and write poetry, and some people just share the best ideas that they've figured out, and some people make movies about things. That's why I think we create, and that's why I think we create art in particular. It is that impossible task of trying to share subjective experience, trying to share what it is to feel and be human. And when I think about why we work, well, in a lot of ways, and in particular, when I think about why we do knowledge work, it is to come together to solve problems that we can't solve on our own. Otherwise, why would we get together? And so, okay, if that is a first principle of it, then to your point, then the Hollywood model makes a ton of sense. this notion that we can have these fully decentralized, even decentralized autonomous organizations, but decentralized organizations, networks, right? So to your point, yeah, I do think the future of work looks very, very different. I believe that organizations are going to look very, very different than they do now, because they don't have to be the same hierarchical structures that we've had in the past. We have created technologies that have freed us from those artificial constraints. And they're now artificial because in the past, look, these were the institutions that were required to organize us in such a way that we don't self-extinct. But if we take everything that we understand about what makes humans work and tick and what motivates us in the first place, and then we can scale up to that societal level, I agree that the future of work looks, I can see a case to be made where it looks a lot more like that project-based model from the entertainment industry. How much more powerful is that going to be when we adopt that same model to tackle things like climate change, like the inequality gap, like the challenges of education and creating more opportunities for creatives, for innovators? So that's kind of what bubbled up as you were talking.
So a question I want to ask you on the flip side of this, obviously, like, this is going to result in so many more people sharing their ideas, their information, and we already have a ton of noise out there, and it's really just going to be so much more, and it feels like curation is going to become super important. How do you personally find the voices that you follow, and how do you suggest others do in the future when we're not going to have things like stamps on institutions that are signaling some kind of status or credibility? Or
I follow my curiosity. I know it might sound like a broken record, and it is, you know, understanding what I'm most interested in. Mm. And so to me, the way that I have been curating my information diet, because that is something that, honestly, the first step to me is thinking about it as an information diet. Look, I am very focused on inputting as much smart information about generative AI in particular and digital transformation as possible. And at the same time, I keep my information inputs as diverse as possible. So look, right now, as we are launching WorkCrafting, and we have this codified methodology, mindset, and movement that we are bringing out into the world, I'm also pressure testing that. But when it comes to my information diet, I think number one with a bullet is curiosity. And then number two, and I will bring in and actively process one of the core concepts that I'm learning from the book that I'm currently reading, 10X is easier than 2X, is thinking about leverage. So thinking about, okay, when it comes to my information diet, how much more value am I going to get? How many more powerful, deep ideas and new mental models or frameworks am I going to learn in some period of time when I could be scrolling through LinkedIn, I could be reading a newspaper, I could be listening to a podcast, I could be reading a book? And I do love the calculus that Steven Kotler worked out in The Art of Impossible, which really talks about and highlights the ROI of books. So to the best of my knowledge, the most effective and efficient input mechanism for getting more information, more data, more knowledge, and more wisdom into my head, that input process, is through books. And I have found a way to habit stack, like we learned about in Zero to Dangerous, and stack reading and exercising with my morning routine that is REM, reminds me of the importance of getting a good night's sleep. And I make sure that I read, exercise, and meditate every morning. And I bring in, you know, the tiny habits, the atomic habits concept. So even if I'm running late, like, and it is one push-up, and I listen to a book for 5 minutes, and I close my eyes and just do a 10 count, breathing in, you know, in and out 10 times. You know, it is making progress every day. But again, it is thinking very exclusively, very, to become much more discriminating. And at the same time, paradoxically, to be as open to what you are inputting, but thinking very deliberately about it.
Mm, definitely agree with you on books. And that was an interesting ROI calculation that Stephen Kotler did. All right. So the last topic I want to make sure we talk about is AI. And specifically, like, I would love to hear your approach to using AI for learning and with the creativity process. And I think specifically with creativity, I'm curious how you balance, on the one hand, there's so much that AI can now do for us. And so that's incredible. And we need to learn the skills to be able to use it better, to get better at asking it questions and prompting. But then also, like, how do you think about the knowledge that you're starting to outsource to AI and the skills that you're potentially starting to erode? Maybe writing is an easy thing to give up to AI. So then how do you then keep those like writing skills sharp, or the other knowledge that you're potentially starting to outsource?
I believe the easiest way to stump an AI expert is to ask them to explain intelligence. So I'll start by saying that, and this will certainly sound like a shameless promotion of my dear friend Kes, but I will promote his Centaurian Substack, because he is taking this very different approach to writing about AI to help people think differently about what AI represents, which, as I said earlier, is this the first technology to our knowledge that humans have created that actually enable us to think with machines. So if you're going to really understand it, the first mental model shift or mind shift that and mindset shift that I did, and I already had this, I had the advantage of having been thinking about AI for a number of years and reading as much as I could. That certainly is something I would recommend to people, is do educate yourself, both intellectually from reading books about it, but absolutely the best way to learn about it and learn how to use it is simply by doing it. Again, if you're doing it, you're doing it right. The number of people who I have talked to who are on the FUD side, the fear, uncertainty, and doubt side of the AI spectrum, the other end being FOMO, fear of missing out. I'm not surprisingly on the FOMO end of the spectrum. To a person, the people who are the most fearful, the most uncertain, the most dubious of AI are the ones who have not actively used it. It is amazing. Play with it. Just explore it. Understand how intelligence works. The other thing that is unprecedented with this technology is it teaches you how to use it. One of the most amazing things to me is that you can literally fire up ChatGPT and say, I don't understand artificial intelligence. I'm scared of it. I don't want to lose the ability to think, but I really want to understand it better. Help me out. This technology will be a bro.
Yeah.
It's like if Gutenberg, when he created the printing press, it simultaneously taught people how to read and write. I mean, that's what this technology is doing. It teaches you, anybody who is willing to, anybody who is curious enough, anybody who is vulnerable enough to say, I don't get this. Help me understand this. That is a phrase that I have really, really come to embrace. So in terms of understanding AI, the most important large language model to help you understand large language models is what sits between your ears. This is actually a great mental model for our brains, is thinking about large language models. So how do large language models get better? Well, they have better training sets, AKA they have better data in them, and they have better algorithms. So they have better processes. How do you get better processes? You learn how your brain actually works. You learn about things like incubation, like question storming. Like, so when it comes to AI, yeah, I am worried about the cognitive atrophy that we are going to see. The people, the same short-sighted, short-term thinking, low-hanging fruit, first-order thinking that we're seeing businesses do with AI, which is automate, 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 try to, you know, drive efficiency without taking a step back to ask themselves some of those questions that sound like the questions that very busy executives don't have time to ask. What is our reason for being a business. What do we actually exist to do? What do we actually do? How do we actually make money? You know, that the lens of jobs to be done. So when it comes to AI, learn as much as you can about it intellectually, use it as much as you can. And the more that you use it, and the more that you take that mindset of how can this augment me? Not what can I automate, but what can I augment? You're going to figure out, it's easy to figure out the things that you can and should and could automate in your life, that you can, could, and should outsource. Mm. But the more you understand about how your brain works in the first place, the better you will be able to really leverage this new technology. Understand how your brain processes information, understand how you output information, and then start thinking about, okay, well, if that's how my brain works, what are the ways that I can best augment that with this amazing new technology? Because it is the first time. It is a cognitive prosthesis. And to your point, there is a very, very real risk that if we outsource the wrong things, if we rely on the wrong things, when it comes to how we think and how we really tap into the most amazing supercomputer we know of in the universe, right? There is deep, deep truth to the statement that a lot of people are seeing, saying, and hearing, which is AI is not going to replace you. Somebody using AI will.
Yeah, it strikes me as needing to be very intentional about what skills you're trying to have in your tool belt and the way we have to practice and do exercise, taking some intentional time to say, okay, I'm going to use AI to write, but then I still need to then set aside time daily, weekly, whatever, to practice writing.
And perhaps to that point, the best way I know of to really learn how to use AI is to learn as much as you can about metacognition, to really think about thinking. And the more that you understand how you think and how your brain works, the better you are going to understand how to use this augmented intelligence. And I do say that very deliberately. I do bristle at thinking of it as artificial intelligence, because I do fundamentally think that is the wrong mental model. This even goes back to, as I've learned from Kez, the original debate in the world of AI between John McCarthy and Marvin Minsky, and that notion of AI versus IA, artificial intelligence versus intelligence augmentation. And again, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. That is one of those rhymes that I think we're seeing play out. And I do see so many people in that race to the bottom, which is thinking of it as artificial intelligence. Oh, what can it do? What can I outsource to it? As opposed to going, wait, how might we augment our intelligence?
Wow. Well, to wrap up, so your mission statement or purpose is to turn FUD into fun. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I will. And it probably won't surprise you that I am actively rethinking my personal purpose statement, which is currently to turn FUD into fun and make the unknown known. Mm. It, as I went through a step-by-step inventory of character strengths and all of the things, really understand my unique unfair advantages, my discovering my wow, and then figuring really how to best articulate it. A couple of years ago, when I went through that, I landed on this phrase, turn FUD into fun. Mm. As I have thought back across my life, as I think forward to this notion of a massive transformative purpose, as Peter Diamandis might say, I know that I can spend the rest of my life trying to turn FUD into fun for myself and others, trying to turn fear, uncertainty, and doubt into fun and make the unknown known. I can and I will spend the rest of my life doing that. And as I have been actively rethinking it, my updated current, and this is fresh out of the hopper this morning, my latest draft personal purpose statement is that I exist to help people learn how to love changing their minds.
I love that. Wow.
More to come, but that there you go. It is something new. We can have, it's a breaking personal announcement that Scott Wolfson, you may know me from my purpose statement, turn FUD into fun, is now all about helping people learn to love changing their minds.
What an open loop you've created. Well, Scott, thank you so much for being here. This was fascinating. Love your energy. Such an incredible conversation. I really appreciate it.
Well, Jenna, as you know, I say with the utmost humility and respect, I'm so grateful to be a part of your life. And I am so grateful for this opportunity to have this very meaningful, very intentional conversation. Thank you so much for your time, energy, and attention.
I hope you enjoyed my episode with Scott Wolfson. Let me know what you thought of it and what lessons you took away by leaving a comment on the Lessons in Creativity Instagram page. Thanks so much, and stay tuned for more lessons.